Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today is Q&A with Layla, and this is part two of our discussion. Layla, how are you doing?
Okay, how are you doing?
Good, good. So what is our next question, please?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, Layla, this is from Richard. I am dealing with plantar fasciitis and have been advised by my podiatrist to do the stretches that you've referred to on Intelligent Medicine. I'm also using a night splint and a shoe insert. What puzzles me, however, is how these work. If stress on the plantar fascia caused by overuse, exercise, etc., causes this, then how does the additional stress in the form of these repeated stretches help the problem? I've not yet obtained relief. One advertised product on the internet is accompanied by a claim that stretching is not the answer. Can you explain how stretching works anatomically?
Okay. Wow, that's a really wonky question about plantar fasciitis. Yeah. First, let's explain what plantar fasciitis is. It sounds a little bit like fascism, right?
Yes.
You know, like a fascist.
Mussolini.
Actually,
okay.
if you look up the word fascism, it actually comes from the Latin word fasces, which is a bundle of sticks that is tied around the middle with a string. Now, you can say, what the heck does that have to do with some kind of authoritarian government or with tendons, right? But stay with me on this. The fasces, if you look at ancient, painting sculptures, more sculptures because there's not a lot of paintings that survive from that period, and actually the Romans were more in, they did painting, but they were more into sculpture. The fasces was a symbol of authority. So if you held up the fasces, this bundle of sticks that was tied together with a string, this would connote that you were the leader of the pack or the dictator or the, you know, head honcho of, you know, the Roman state, or at the very least a governor or a powerful person. So that this got translated into a modern term, fascism, which is authoritarian government. Okay, so now what does that have to do with a tendon? Well, actually, the tendons pass through little narrow passageways in the legs, in the hands, in the feet, and you think of the tendons like the sticks and the bands that hold them together sometimes or surround them sometimes will constrict them, and mm-hmm. you'll get, instead of nice lubrication and sliding, you'll get sort of a riching, and that's what causes the fasciitis. So that mm-hmm. plantar is like the bottom surface of the feet, and plantar fasciitis is often accompanied by, and I've had it, because it's a common runner's injury. And it also is something that just occurs a lot of people when they reach a certain age, because the tendons tend to become more desiccated. They dry up, but they also shorten and tighten unless you're a dedicated stretcher. And I was guilty of doing a lot of exercise, but perhaps without the requisite stretching. So what happens is when you develop plantar fasciitis, the first sign is that you can get out of bed and, you know, like the first moment when your feet touch the floor and maybe you go off to the bathroom, your heels are very, very painful. The heels are particularly painful. Sometimes it's excruciating and people can't even walk. For me, it was like, you know, the first few minutes would be pretty painful. Then I'd walk it off, but I'd sometimes feel it walking around. So I didn't have a very bad case of it, but enough to, you know, get my attention and reduce my running volume. One of the thoughts behind this is that this results from a weakening of the arch because we wear such great footwear all the time. And this is actually one of the theories behind paleo running, is that if you run barefoot, or if you spend a lot of time walking barefoot, as the human foot was originally intended, you will really strengthen and stretch the muscles of your feet with each footstep. Mm-hmm. When you're comfortably ensconced in a shoe, you just sort of clop, you know, you clop your foot down on the ground, and it just, you know, it's
your
not
toes aren't really working or anything. It's just pushing off. Yes.
Yeah, you're just clopping your foot down on the ground. So you're not actually working all the muscles of your feet. And then as a result, there's a contraction or constriction of those, the fascies or the tendons within there. And so
Does stretching help?
Well, okay, so bottom line, I did everything. I mean, short of surgery, and also I refused to have a steroid shot. They said, you know, you could have a steroid shot, but that just gives you temporary relief, and then, you know, it's kind of like what the athletes do. That, you know, when they're in trouble, they just give them a steroid shot, like once, twice, three, to, you know, four or five times. After a while, you can actually weaken and damage the tendon because the steroid actually thins it out. So I didn't want
to mention your bones as well.
Right.
After a period of time, yeah.
Right. So, yes, once again, the conventional medicine police are after me here. I'll have to, you can hear, can you hear sirens in the background?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, periodically it's like the diary. It's like the Diary of Anne Frank, except they had those European sirens in those days. Okay. as an aside, for those of you who are not familiar with our podcast, we record these in New York City, and we provide you with the real sounds of the city in the background from time to time. So the other thing that you can do is you can put your feet in splints at night. See, typically when you lie in bed, you extend your feet sort of in line with your legs, and that also tends to reduce the stretch on your tendons. It shortens the tendons. So I was wearing this on the foot affected. It was fortunately just one foot at a time. That would keep my foot at a right angle, and it wasn't painful. It didn't hurt to do that, but it just prevented my foot from going into a neutral. And I did this for several months until I was better. And now, of course, I've abandoned it. But you know, it's kind of, you know, looks a little ridiculous. Yeah. You have your foot in a splint. And then I also got arches, which are controversial because some people say the arches can make it worse ultimately. But actually, the arches help to prevent my foot from flattening out more. I have a bit of a flat foot. And I actually cushioned my heel so that it wouldn't be painful to walk. And
stretching would be beneficial, would you say?
People
it
swear,
would be beneficial because
people swear,
you know,
by different
walking,
things.
Yeah.
People swear by different things. I mean, look, stretching, there's no question, is beneficial, but you also, part of it is also to stretch your calves. And I actually had problems not just in my foot at the time, but I had problems in occasional calf muscle strain on that side, and I actually had a hamstring tightness. So all the muscles in the back of my leg leading down to my foot were foreshortened, and so I've undertaken a program of overall stretching. I stretch my hamstrings, I stretch my calves. You know, the Achilles tendon, of course, is linked to the plantar fascia, and it's all part of the same line. And you have to think of a whole body dynamic. Now, the other thing that can be done is you can do a therapy that's called extracorporeal shockwave therapy, which is sometimes employed by podiatrists. It's actually used to smash kidney stones, but in this case, they smash the fascia and sort of break it up a little bit. So, in effect, that allows it to stretch more because you're in effect doing sort of micro tears of your fascia, which ultimately, you know, I would think that could be very painful and that would cause it to hurt more. But actually, it allows it to stretch more so that there's less tension in your your fascia. So I think it biomechanically,
makes sense. Dr. Hoffman, if it's going to cause micro tears, would we worry then about adhesions or anything like that?
Yeah, you know what my podiatrist said is, I said, well, what if I, hypothetically, you know, is running bad because, God forbid it, what if I tear my fascia? Isn't it a terrible accident? And they said, no, actually, that actually helps.
Go tear your fascia.
Yeah, I mean, they said, I mean, theoretically, that wouldn't be a problem. Not that I did it. And, you know, so often this is self-limited. I also took a variety of supplements, anti-inflammatory supplements. I took lots of fish oil. I took magnesium because it helps with muscle relaxation. I took curcumin and boswellin. These are natural anti-inflammatories. I even took Wobenzyme for a while. I did there's a Topperson foot cream that is helpful for this. And, you know, so there, I mean, there are probably a million different solutions because this is a really challenging problem. And we invite our listeners to weigh in with answers if they have an answer, something that they found very helpful for them. I'm very satisfied that I've worked my way out of a problem. I also emphasize more cycling and more swimming rather than running because I was doing a lot of running mileage at the time.
Dr. Hoffman, didn't you also try the MELT method?
Yeah, indeed. Oh, I thank you for mentioning that. I also used the MELT method, M-E-L-T. Exactly, by Sue Hitzman, which is something you can find out about on the Internet. And it involves using balls of various hardness on your feet and massaging your feet with the balls and also stretching using a roller. So that this, I think, could be helpful. And short of that, you could also just try massaging your foot with a golf ball, you know, like a hard ball.
Very good.
Yeah, because that will bring circulation to your feet and provide some stretching. So anything you can do along those lines.
Okay. Best of luck to Richard.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, the good news is that it's often self-limited.
Yeah. We've got another question here. We don't have a name. Oh, no, it's from Ron. I thought I was looking at your name.
My namesake, yeah.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I just listened to your Intelligent Medicine podcast on resveratrol. I'd like to start drinking red wine. How do I know which red wine has good resveratrol content?
Wait a minute. This is really, this is an interesting thing, because there are some people out there who are teetotalers, and then they hear about the benefits of alcohol. So what, for a lot of people, that's fine. But I don't want to be guilty of someone who is, who's a teetotaler, and happily so, and decides that, gee, that's unhealthy. I got to start drinking wine. And then pretty soon they end up on the Bowery.
Exactly. You know? I'm not a fan, and I tell this to our patients who are teetotalers. Oh, maybe I should get my resveratrol. I could have a glass of Pinot Noir.
Right.
No, don't start drinking. If you don't drink now, don't start. This is not a reason to do it.
Right.
Take Longevinex instead.
Yes.
You're getting more resveratrol that way. But given this question...
And by the way, we're not from the Women's Christian Temperance Union here. We believe in the pleasant and social aspects and relaxing aspects of drinking wine and appreciating a cocktail occasionally, if you do well with it. But there's so many people who either, you know, they feel sluggish and lethargic, or they get toxic from alcohol, or they,
Or they're yeasty and they shouldn't have the wine to begin with.
So it's kind of like, the most amazing man in the world. He said, I don't drink beer very much, but when I do, I drink, that commercial.
I don't know.
Beer
what
commercial.
Did he drink? Was it Beck's?
I don't want to advertise a beer. But the point is, if you drink wine and you want to maximize its nutritional benefits, what's the best wine to have?
The best wine to have, actually, and I've researched this a little bit, and my brother-in-law is also a wine aficionado. He's from Rome himself. There's a grape in Sardinia. It's called the Cannonau grape. That's Cannonau, the Cannonau grape from Sardinia. What it really is the Grenache. So any kind of Grenache wine will have more, maybe, possibly resveratrol than a different wine that uses a different grape. That could be something. What you have to be careful with a little bit with Grenache is they tend to be a little sweeter, but not all.
You've looked this up, and you can actually tell
the
resveratrol content of wine.
They claim to have the most resveratrol or the most antioxidant.
And where's it from?
Grape from Sardinia.
Sardinia. Okay, so this is an important aspect of the resveratrol story. Resveratrol amounts are actually increased under conditions of stress, like a little bit of drought, or a little bit of heat, or a little bit of a cold snap, can actually increase the compounds that are present in plants, which protect the plants from stress. These are natural antioxidant compounds. So wines that arise in very mild temperate climates where it's perfect, they may be delicious wines, they just don't have as much resveratrol in them.
Yeah. so that would be it.
Just specific brand
or Grenache? I've seen a wine called actually Cannonau. It is the Cannonau grape. It's from Sardinia, obviously. But no, not a particular brand off the top of my head.
You see, resveratrol is something called a phytoalexin. A phytoalexin, which I'm looking it up here. These are antimicrobial and often antioxidative substances synthesized by plants that accumulate rapidly at areas of pathogen infection. So even like a fungal infection, and actually the wine growers recognize that there's kind of a helpful synergy between a mild fungal infection on a plant and the quality or taste of the wine. So this is actually something that, you know, you say, oh my God, the grapes are spoiled. They've got a fungus on them. No, actually, certain bacteria or fungi are part of the wine grower's craft.
Yeah.
So,
is true.
It's an interesting thing.
Yeah, grape skins do tend to be yeasty. It kind of helps the whole fermentation process.
Uh huh.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even very, very, very overripe fruit is going to still contain 1-2% alcohol. Did anybody know that? Who knew? Wow.
Wow.
Not that that means anything, but, you know, it's still, yeah, that's interesting.
Okay. Can you get, a DUI if you have, like, too much...
I hope not. If you eat a bag of grapes, overripe grapes.
Hopefully not. You get a little stone from the sugar, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true.
Okay. So, any additional questions on today's podcast?
Yeah. We have one from Bob. Mm-hmm. Why is it so difficult for some people to build muscle? I've been lifting weights for 20 years and have seen no increase whatsoever in my arms and legs. My son has the same problem. Mm-hmm. I've had testosterone treatment with no results. I'm 140 pounds and 5 feet 10 in height.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Bob.
Okay. So, you know, look, I think there's certainly a hormonal component. I mean, if you look at the women who have, like, incredible musculature, it's almost like a caricature of a woman's figure. Many of them are taking anabolic steroids to get that popped out vein muscle definition look. Mm-hmm. So the more estrogen you have, the less you might have very well-defined muscles. And of course, testosterone is what gives you big muscles. But barring the testosterone deficiency, there are a lot of genetic components to muscular size. I think, for example, even if I were to undertake the workout regimen of Arnold Schwarzenegger, even if I had his determination, I could not end up looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger, even through, better living through chemistry and all the juicing technology that he used, because he obviously used, growth hormone, this, that, and the other thing. Growth hormone is another factor that has to do with muscle size, and it's possible that a person may have adequate testosterone but not adequate growth hormone. I don't recommend that you take growth hormone merely to get big muscles. You know, I just think that there are too many downsides, and you might look great, but I don't think it's going to be good for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big fan of growth hormone, except, for very sick individuals might get after a hip fracture, if you're an elderly person, it might help you heal faster. But just to take it to look awesome, not a good idea.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
You have to sort of think of some super fit individuals. Like if you look at bantamweight fighters, these are men who weigh maybe 125 pounds and they're super fit and strong. And yet they don't have, sort of small size muscles, not large volume muscles, but they're very strong. They have good endurance. And I think, rather than, form without function, like huge bulging muscles, which is so fashionable these days, I think the goal of good health is to be strong.
It's much more important to be strong.
To be strong, to be balanced, to be also flexible, because I think you can really be muscle bound, and that's terrible because you can, you see some of these guys and they can, if they drop their, if they drop their dumbbells on the floor, they can barely reach down to pick them up. They're so muscle bound. Are there other factors involved?
I'm looking at his weight for his height, 140 pounds, 5 feet 10. That's a BMI of 20, which is fine. But I wonder if Bob is knows how to lift weights. I mean, is he hauling enough weight?
That's a good point. Yeah.
The last few reps should be very, very, very difficult. If they're not, and you're flying through your repetitions and your two or three sets of lifts, then it's not enough weight that you're hauling.
It's a matter of technique. Yeah. Any trainers will ask you. They'll say, "Hey, do you want to be strong and aerobically fit, or do you want to just really get, you know, blown out, you know, pumped up muscles?" And yeah. Somebody's trained, like they're training a movie star for a movie role, they are going to train them for show, you know, it's like like a show dog basically, as opposed to, you know, the goals of overall fitness. And you have to get to what's called failure. So when I train, I might lift a weight, you know, 15 or 20 or 25 times for overall strength, because I told my trainer, look, I like my size 40 regular suits, and I don't want to have to throw away my suits and get a size 42. So just keep me fit and strong. But if I wanted to really get bulked, which actually I got up to like a size 44 once when I was in my 40s. It was ridiculous. But I was doing like reps of 5 or 7 reps to real strain and failure. I was bench pressing my body weight much heavier weight, and with fewer reps to real exhaustion, to what's called failure, which is when the muscles like become tremulous. And then you actually are damaging your muscles. But in
lots of micro tears there.
Right. Yeah. But in the damaging of the muscles, they then repair and they get bigger. They hypertrophy in response to the stress. So there's a technique of doing this. But, they discovered with animals that there is a and I hate to see what happens when this gets commercialized, but they actually came up with a genetic treatment. And they showed, like, I don't know what kind of animal it was. I think it was like a mouse. It was a dog. And what they what they did is they gave the dog this genetic splice, and the dog looked like it was like the Arnold Schwarzenegger of dogs. It had massive muscles.
I hope it wasn't a pit bull or a mastiff.
It just had massive muscles just from this one gene. So indicating that this is just a genetic factor that caused very pronounced muscle hypertrophy, and it unfortunately. You know, once they discover something like this, it's got tremendous potential for abuse once it's unleashed into the marketplace. But that suggests that there is a genetic factor, and that if you don't have that muscle-bound gene, you're just going to end up, the goal is fitness, not awesomeness.
Right.
Okay. I hope we can talk about creatine. I think creatine can give you a little more muscle volume.
Yeah.
Not much, but a little. What it does is it actually hydrates the muscles a little bit. You could try 5 milligrams of creatine 3 times daily. That is sometimes something that helps with volume if you're looking for muscle volume and appearance.
Yeah. Branched chain amino acids in whey protein is often helpful.
10 or 12 grams, you'd have to take that as a powder. You know, what is that? Leucine, isolucine, and valine?
Yes.
Yeah, those are the three. And you know, a lot of these things are available in health food stores, you know, GNCs, place like that, in big tubs, you know, with super muscle-bound pictures on the front with the veins popping out. But it's not like instant muscles in the body. You know, the proteins or the amino acid building blocks there don't magically jump into your muscles and cause your muscles to bulge. You have to do the work.
Okay. Best of luck to Bob.
But this discussion is like, you know, it's on Bob's mind, but it's on the mind of every 14-year-old boy in America. Is there when I was growing up, you know, we read the magazines, you know, like, don't be a 97-pound weakling, don't get sand kicked in your face, you know, get the Charles Atlas system, you know, it was in the back of every comic book. But we were just not so fixated on being huge then. So it was like okay to be a little bit of a skinny string bean, because you knew that by the time, you know, you were 20 or 25, you were going to start growing a little more broad shoulder. Now every teenager wants to be totally awesome. It's like boys and men have unrealistic models, you know, just like women have unrealistic models to uphold.
That's true.
You know, boys are, it's like they see these super pumped up athletes, often artificially pumped up, and actors, and sometimes these actors are actually CGI'd, you know, with, you know, digital photoshopping.
That's
and,
true.
And that's what they aspire to. And it's, I think
actually, most of them are, especially in magazines.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
I think
so. Even what we're looking at is not really real most of the time. Anyway,
it's an it's an illusory ideal, and I think it it messes up the heads and the bodies of many of our youth in this country.
Yeah, body dysmorphic disorder,
right.
To some degree.
That being said, all right. Yeah. So I think it was a good, well-rounded discussion of that subject. So that's all we have for this week's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Q&A with Layla will reappear next week. Send us your questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place to email us your questions. And if your question is succinct and germane, we will field it on our next podcast. Thanks very much for joining us today, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.